This is an ABC podcast.
Ian McCalman is back on Conversations today. Ian's an historian, and last time Ian was here, it was all about his love of the Great Barrier Reef. Today, he's got a very different tale. It's a story that begins for him with a bizarre family heirloom. And this led him, in a roundabout way, to the life of a brilliant and long-forgotten woman named Delia Akeley. Delia Akeley was born into a dirt-poor family in America's Midwest. She married a man who became the father of modern taxidermy. And together, the two of them created dioramas for the Natural History Museum in Chicago and in New York. But this was in the earliest years of the 20th century, and the animals in these displays were created from the flesh of real-life elephants and other beasts that the two of them hunted together on several African expeditions. And Delia herself shot and killed several charging bull elephants. But while in Africa, Delia became fascinated by the social lives of the little monkeys near her camp, and she adopted one of them, a little vervet monkey that she named JT Jr. And she brought her back to New York with her so that she could observe her behaviour in the confines of a Manhattan apartment. Ian McCalman's book about the life of this brilliant, brave and infuriating woman is called Delia and the Monkey. Hello, Ian. Welcome back.
Oh, thanks so much, Richard. It's lovely to be back.
This story starts for you, like I said, with this strange memento, this bizarre family heirloom that was lying around the family home when you were a kid. Tell me about this object, please.
Yes, it's an extraordinary object. And in fact, I'm looking at it right now. Look, it looks like a little bowl made out of what you might think of tortoise shell. And it's got a silver solid ball feet at the bottom and then silver lining around the edge. And on the side of it, engraved in black, LJT from TR. And LJT was my great uncle, Leslie Jeffress Tarleton, an Australian, and TR is Theodore Roosevelt, the President of the United States. And this memento is of a young elephant that they shot in 1909. And it came down to us because Uncle Les had the largest safari in Africa, starting from nothing. And this was kind of an inheritance that came to our house. And it's a grotesque object, which my sister and I thought was kind of funny. You're supposed to fill it full of chocolates and nuts on Christmas Day and then, you know, hand them round to people. And then you tell them, as we were kids, we delighted in this. You tell them, those are elephants' toenails.
It's made from elephants' toenails.
Yes.
Oh, dear. Why had Teddy Roosevelt given this to your great-uncle?
Yeah, so great-uncle Les came from initially from Adelaide and fought in the Boer War with a mate over in South Africa. And after the end of the war, they trekked up to Kenya. They got a soldier settlement up in Kenya, and they tried to farm it and it failed. And in the end, they were sort of sitting around when they actually bumped into Carl Akeley, the husband of Delia, and the man who was to become one of the most famous collectors, hunters, and I suppose taxidermists of the world. As a result of getting to know Akeley and helping him, they in turn set up a safari, just a safari company in this tin shack. And when Roosevelt decided he was going to have a post-presidential enormous holiday, he was persuaded by Akeley to go to Africa and have a massive, massive safari there. And as it happens, of course, they asked Uncle Les's company, which was called Newland Tarleton, to become Roosevelt's safari company and to take him on this absolutely extraordinary year-long slaughter. But it was also a year-long collection of animals for the museum back in America.
So this is when your great-uncle Les met the woman at the centre of your book, Delia Akeley.
That's right.
Tell me about her background. I mentioned she came from a dirt poor background. What can you tell me about that?
Yeah, she came from an Irish-American background. They're called Dennings, and they had nine children. She was the youngest of them, and the youngest woman too. And they sort of eked out a very rough living on this dirt poor farm in Wisconsin. And she was from the outset, she was a little rebel. They called her a devil. And she was nicknamed Mickey as a kind of tomboy. And you can see that from the outset, she was someone who was unprepared to be kicked around by her father or the rest of the family. And she showed a very rebellious personality. And eventually, I think when she was maybe about 18, she ran away. The father told her to go out and to carry water to all of the workers on his farm. And she just decided, I've had enough. And she ran away.
And where did she go then?
Well, she met a young barber whom she married, and she would have been about 17 at this point. And this guy happened to be friendly with the local museum hunter and taxidermist, who was Carl Akeley. And so she got to know him. She was fascinated by him. He was an incredibly charismatic guy. And she started to help him collect animals and collect materials for his kind of extraordinary displays that were meant to be very, very ultra realistic.
So she divorced her husband then and got hitched to Carl Akeley.
That's right.
And started to work with him in some of the major natural history museums in the United States. So what was the mission of those museums?
Well, eventually the major mission, and this is at the American Museum of Natural History in New York, the major mission was to get, that they were sent on an expedition to get six elephants, to produce a kind of elephant family which would be in the museum. And it is in the museum. If you go and see it, you'll see it there. It's a spectacular elephant family of six animals. And that was the task they were sent on in 1905. And she was going along not in any way to be involved, except the museum master to collect materials on African, especially women, African women, their ways of life. So that's what she was doing there, while he was there to kill six perfect, as he said, elephants.
So that was the beginning of their first expedition to Africa in 1905, working together. Now, she was trained to shoot an elephant in the wild. What does that involve, to your knowledge? And not that you've done it yourself, but what do you understand is involved in that process?
Well, I've seen my father was a big game photographer. I've seen his pictures of elephants. These are before the days of very, very big distance telescopy. And you can see this massive animal standing, 12 foot tall and weighing tons with their ears up. They look as though they're a monster.
These are African elephants with big ears. They're much bigger creatures.
That's right.
And they're way more territorial, aren't they?
Absolutely. They are just way wilder.
So you can shoot an elephant like that once while it's charging towards you, and then you've got to shoot it again and again and again. Is that how it goes?
Well, it certainly did with Delia, because what happened with her is she was threatened with a lion one day. So she determined that she ought to get a gun and find how to defend herself. And her husband thought it was a joke that she should learn to shoot. It turned out she was an incredible shot. And so he decided to take her out on a safari to shoot an elephant. And the first elephant she saw was so magnificent she couldn't shoot it. She just was both paralyzed and absolutely elated to see this animal. The second time she did shoot the elephant, and it happened to be a record size elephant with record tusks. For a long time, that first elephant that she shot was the biggest that had ever been shot.
Now, you mentioned that she was seen as a dead shot, but being a dead shot is about absolute stone-cold calmness under pressure, it would seem.
Absolutely. And the thing is, the sad thing about it is she'd hated shooting, really. She accepted the idea that, I mean, back in those days, that science demanded that you kill these animals and recreate them in order that people can know about them. This is prior to, you know, making films of these animals. And so she believed that it was necessary. But then having to actually do this terrifying thing, you have to shoot so accurately, and they're coming at you at probably 50 kilometres an hour.
Trampling down trees and bushes and making this hell of a noise.
Oh, absolutely.
It's terrifying. It's like being attacked by, I suppose, a double-decker bus with its horn on all the time, I suppose,
that's
essentially.
Exactly right.
So while she's there, she's seeing and doing these extraordinary things. Tell me how she was then drawn into the social lives of the monkeys living near their camp.
Yes, her husband was out often on safaris, and she was on her own, and she started to develop attachment to watching monkeys' social life. To be honest, I think she really wanted a child, and her husband absolutely insisted that they were not going to have a child. So she was watching the families in a kind of wistful way, and absolutely entranced by the social life of these animals. She'd go out at night, or she'd lie under a bush in the day and watch them for hours upon hours. And she was, in fact, kind of teaching herself monkey knowledge.
What was she noticing about the roles of males and females and how that might pertain to the life she was living?
Well,
at the time?
It was pretty obvious to her that the males kicked the females around as much as possible, took all the best food and were dominant. And she saw her own life in a way. I mean, she loved Carl Akeley, but he was an incredibly bossy man. I mean, this is a man, by the way, who'd killed a wounded leopard with his bare hands on one occasion.
Was he marked by that?
He was extremely marked by it, heavily scarred. So in a way, what she was seeing was a life where in the monkey world, the males were incredibly dominant and domineering. And in her own world, so were they the same.
So that's when she decided she wanted to capture, is that the word, one of these little monkeys?
Yes, she got into an argument with one of the hunters who was with them, who said monkeys were disgusting, filthy creatures, and he hated them. And she was so angry about that she persuaded a young boy who worked with them to go out and get a monkey to show this guy that in the wild, monkeys are beautifully, you know, beautifully kept, that it was only in zoos that you saw the sort of degradation that can surround them.
So what kind of monkey was it that she went to get?
So it was a vervet monkey, which are beautiful little monkeys, quite common in East Africa, and as it turns out, remarkably intelligent monkeys with enormous powers of communication. And this tiny little monkey came, and you know, it was about a year old. It was an infant monkey, and it was female, and it was really feisty and angry, and she completely loved its fiery spirit, you know.
How did she then discover that this monkey, whom she named JT Jr., far from being an unclean animal, actually enjoyed bathing?
Oh, yeah, that was one of her experiences. She didn't have any idea that monkeys enjoyed getting into water. One day she's having a wash in the tent, you know, where they have no running water, but they put the hot water in the bath, and she's lying there in the bath. And the monkey comes in, vaults onto her head, then swims down into the water, and then starts splashing her and eating the soap, and eventually the monkey drives her out of the little bath. And from then on, this monkey showed that it had to have a bath every single day.
So she took JT with her once they left camp, away from the family. I wonder if she understood what that would mean for JT, this little monkey.
Well, see, she didn't understand. One of the tragedies of this was she had every intention of taking the monkey back. She borrowed it from the, as she thought, you know, from this community around them, in the trees around them. But then she discovered she was going to take it back. She discovered, she was told, if you take this monkey back into the community, they will tear it to pieces. Once the monkey has gone out and become kind of, as it were, connected to humans, the community sees them as dangerous and kills them. So she now had to, she had to stay with the monkey for the rest of her life. And so she's adjusting herself to having this monkey that she now finds she has to live with. And what she feels most deeply, first of all, is shame at having done this, incidentally kind of captured this monkey. And secondly, a determination that the monkey should live as wild a life as possible, to try and recreate the kind of life that it had in the world. So on safari, that's what they were doing. She was busy trying to make sure that the monkey was all right and make sure that the monkey had the kind of food, had the kind of games, had the kind of community involvement that she would have had if she was still with her people in the trees on the Tana River.
You know, it seems like she did understand that she ought not to do that thing that humans inevitably do with animals that appeal to us, which is to anthropomorphize them, to treat them like they're little cute humanoid creatures, when of course they're not. They're not human at all. Did she begin to do that nonetheless and start to treat JT like a human child?
Yes, she did. She became torn between two things. One was she was so fascinated with them, she wanted to study the monkey genuinely. And, you know, that did mean that in the end she became a really quite remarkable primatologist in her knowledge about the monkey. And she's on that side also trying to keep the monkey as wild as possible. On the other hand, she falls in love with it as a child. The monkey is very, very small, very cute, very dependent on her. The monkey gets sick and she looks after the monkey. The monkey gets terrifyingly cold and scared. So we get this kind of tension in her life between, on the one hand, absolutely adoring this monkey as a surrogate child, on the other hand, wanting the monkey to be wild.
Did she let the monkey sleep with her?
She did. That was a bit of a bit of a mistake, really.
Carl had a view of that, I'm sure, didn't he? Her husband probably didn't care for that very much, I'm guessing.
He wasn't that chuffed with the whole idea. On the other hand, the truth is that he was such a fanatical worker that he actually slept in a separate tent anyway, because he worked at night with all the animals that he'd killed in the day, you know, skinning them and preserving them and doing all these kinds of things. And that came first for him. He was absolutely driven by this mission to recreate the animals of Africa when they were dead and then take them to America for people to see. So it wasn't that he was that put out, because he wasn't actually sleeping in the same tent. But nevertheless,
there's suddenly a monkey in their married life.
Exactly.
A surrogate child. So at this point, they hooked up on their expedition with Teddy Roosevelt's safari. Now, this is Teddy Roosevelt, the great reforming president of the early 20th century. He just served out his two terms as president and was an ex-president. What was Teddy Roosevelt doing trampling around the jungles and savannas of Africa at that time?
Well, what he was doing was notionally on a holiday, a post-presidential holiday. He was a really fanatical and knowledgeable naturalist, so he loved the natural world. But he was also a person who was completely gripped by masculinity. He'd been, as a child, very sickly, and he'd overcome it. And he believed that you would, through will, a male should overcome all all kinds of obstacles.
Now, this isn't a 21st century feminist interpreter. He would actually say this literally, wouldn't he? He would say this is the manly challenge of nature. This is how we become more manly, and this is good for the vigour of the male specimen, if you like.
More than good for the vigour. He thought it was essential. Actually, he thought that males in America were becoming effeminate because they were too much involved in the commercial life. And he really decided that one of the reasons he took one of his weediest, as he called him, son, was to turn him into a male fighter.
I think he said the best kind of man is a Bostonian who spent 10 years west of the Mississippi. So he's got the benefits of high civilization, but also he's been exposed to the rigors of the wild.
Absolutely. And he loved his kids. He had four boys and a girl. But when the First World War started and the boys were all going to fight in the war, he's at the harbor when they're about to leave and he gives them a talk. And he says he hopes that one, at least one of them will be killed or wounded in order to demonstrate the importance of what it is for males to do for their country.
So with all of that, this is the same Teddy Roosevelt who could identify the bird song of very specific birds while in the wild, who genuinely loved the wild and the natural world, the man who created the national parks system in the United States. And yet, while on safari in Africa, he managed to collect 11,400 animal specimens, including a specimen of the northern white rhino, which were already endangered at the time. How does that fit into his worldview, this love of nature, this love of conservation, a word he often used, with this desire to go out and hunt and kill all these beautiful animals?
He thought that Africa was the last bastion of an older kind of world, the world of the dinosaurs. And the dangerous animals absolutely intrigued him. He saw it as a kind of conquest. A conquest of these animals was absolutely essential. It was a kind of reenactment of what humans had once had to do when they fought dinosaurs.
Yeah, but they didn't have guns and they were looking for food most of the time.
Absolutely.
So it's a different contest, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
I still can't figure out how he saw this as being all part of, not separate to, his conservation mission.
It's a real puzzle. First of all, he was not very good at actually, because he had poor vision, he would open fire at about 300 yards. And he opened fire at everything. I mean, he shot at everything. And when he'd kill an elephant, this was for him the absolutely extreme expression of masculinity. A man against a monster, and he had beaten the monster. So that was that. But then when he's thinking about things in his different mode, which is thinking about whether there should be animals should survive and so on, then he's very busy happily trying to start game parks and look after their survival. And in fact, he wanted animals to survive so you could keep on shooting them.
Delia's husband Carl revered Teddy Roosevelt for the rest of his life. But the thing about these animals, of course, is that sometimes they do get the better of you. Tell me the story of what happened when Delia and Carl went on a visit to Mount Kenya, when Carl met with this horrific accident.
Yes, so he was obsessed with trying to find a big, big, old, big elephant. And a lot of them had already been knocked over. They were hard to find. For the size of elephant he wanted to take back to America, they'd probably have to have been about 75 years old. And very few of them survived. So he was up in this mountainous area in Mount Kenya, looking and taking pictures, but he had a gun with him, and suddenly an elephant burst out of the bushes and he couldn't even get the gun to fire. So he was immediately struggling, and he had thought about this, and he vaulted underneath the tusks. The elephant then tried to squash him, but it was luckily enough there was some obstacle in the earth that stopped it. But nevertheless, he crushed a large amount of him and stripped part of his face and then ran off thinking he was dead.
So how did Delia find out what had happened to him?
Well, one of the Africans who was there tracked back down to where Delia was, a long way away at the bottom of the mountain, and told Delia that her husband had been hit by an elephant and was close to death.
They didn't want to go back because they were frightened and it was nighttime. Tell me how Delia persuaded them to accompany her on a rescue mission for her husband.
Yes, I mean, sort of understandably, they mutinied on the evening. She was going to take them back in the middle of the night up this mountain, which was known to have very dangerous elephants. And they just didn't want to go. They refused to go. So she, and this was one of her techniques, I suppose, is that she would taunt them. She would say, look, you know what you are. You are like girls. You're like me. You're like a girl. But you're too scared to go on this expedition. And eventually they'd start to laugh. And as soon as they laughed, they were, prepared to do it.
So what state was Carl in when she found him with the porters?
He was as near dead as you could imagine. He was covered in blood. And so she patches him up. She's already sent to get a mission doctor who eventually arrived and stitched him up. And then she built a little contraption for him to be laid on. And then they take him back down to the bottom of the mountain in the middle of the night. And she saved his life.
How long did she nurse him for to bring him back to health in Africa?
She nursed him for about 4 months then in the tent with the monkey, entertaining him as well. He was really badly smashed up. A remarkably tough man, though. I mean, he did recover gradually.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler. Hear more conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app, or go to abc.net.au/conversations.
So at the end of this expedition, Ian, she and Carl, along with JT Jr., go back to New York together. How on earth did this little monkey get on in a hotel room in Manhattan?
The challenge really was that Delia wanted the monkey to try and, she wanted it to have a life like a monkey would have had. She wanted it to be able to have kind of freedom, to be able to roam up a tree, to do all those things. And she's living in an apartment in New York, overlooking, well, first of all in a hotel and then in an apartment overlooking the Central Park. And so what we have for the, you know, for I suppose for the next really years from about 1912 to 1917, she's in this apartment and she's studying the monkey. She's studying it in the most extraordinary way. Everything that it does, she's noticing and talking about. And she's also entertaining it, trying to allow the monkey to, you know, roam freely all over their house, tearing up things, jumping all over the ceiling, tearing up her clothes.
Ian, this is mad.
It's madness.
It's total madness.
It's total madness.
Now, what view did Carl, her husband, take of having to share a hotel room and then an apartment with a little monkey like this?
Well, initially he was quite enthusiastic. He liked to play with the monkey because the monkey was a vigorous monkey and he was a vigorous man, and so that, you know, they would roll around on the floor and chase each other around the place and so on.
A little bit of Africa in the big city then, in other words.
Exactly. But gradually, as he is becoming more and more obsessed with his work, trying to produce this incredible set of dioramas, which you can still see today, there are 40 of them, of the animals of Africa that he's recreating. He's obsessed with his work, and she's obsessed with her work, and her work is to study the monkey, and she introduces the monkey to have various friends who live and die while this is going on.
These are monkey
other
friends.
Monkey friends.
How did the monkey respond? How did JT respond to things like music?
Well, this is an extraordinary thing. She discovers all these strange things about the monkey. First of all, the monkey had strong taste in music, hated Caruso. Monkey hated domineering men. She hated domineering men.
Well, maybe, yeah, well, I suppose. Yeah,
there you go.
Strident men, perhaps, yes.
Yes. Anyway, she loved the kind of crooners. But also her absolute favourite was Bach's Minuet in C. And this would actually calm her down if she was ever upset. So she discovers all these extraordinary things about monkeys. I mean, some of them are quite important discoveries about monkeys and their self-consciousness, their morality, their different ways of tricking you, all these kinds of things which have become quite recently understood by primatologists. So she was, you know, she was in that sense, she was a pioneer of understanding monkeys because she absolutely dedicated herself to it.
We're only beginning to understand the emotional lives of animals. This is like a whole new area because for a very long while it was thought that they didn't have emotional lives, which is kind of crazy, as anyone who's lived alongside an animal or a pet would absolutely know. And you mentioned tricks. Was JT able to use charm or beguile her way around humans and act out emotions that she didn't really feel? Was she manipulative, I suppose, is what I'm asking.
Oh, absolutely. On one occasion, you know, when one of her little monkey friends died, she'd mope around. And what she was trying to do was keep Delia in the premises. She didn't want her to go out. She wanted to stay there and play with her and look after her. So she was moping around and looking miserable, and Delia really thought she might die of starvation. Anyway, one day she does have to go out, and when she comes back, her husband, Ake, said the monkey just immediately started playing with him and was as cheerful as anything. So then they conducted an experiment where she's there with the monkey and the monkey's miserable and everything. She goes out, you know, and hides outside the door. And the monkey immediately starts playing and romping around. She comes back in and the monkey, in effect, says, "Oh, okay. Caught me out." Stops that behaviour altogether.
Which implies a kind of moral sensibility. Or is this weird? I don't know. That there's a kind of like, oh, I've been naughty here. I don't know. Is that human projection? Or do we think that monkeys can have that sense of, what is it, moral responsibility or something like that?
I think they can. And, you know, she had mentioned several occasions, and when the monkey showed great compassion to her when she was sick, or the monkey would then, you know, come and look after her, as it had in fact looked after her husband when he was really, you know, knocked up in the tent. So yeah, the moral life comes out of the fact that they're immensely sociable creatures, and they've had to develop, you know, find people to support them in their monkey world, relatives to help them, and so on. So all the idea that they have no sense of morality is really very, very, I think, crudely wrong.
You write that JT was a jealous monkey for
yes.
Delia's affections, and learned how to wreck preparations for dinner parties by sweeping crockery and cutlery from the dining room table onto the floor, or shredding off strips of wallpaper and the like. What was Delia's attitude towards this kind of naughty behaviour?
You know, we go back to this original dilemma. She wants the monkey to be wild, and she refuses to discipline the monkey. She wants the monkey to be wild because she feels so guilty. So she just puts up with it. And, you know, it is a mistake that she made, really, because the monkey, she should have been disciplining her monkey even if she was a monkey child.
So this is really about her guilt then, about her of having pulled JT out of the wild.
Yes. Oh. And to be fair, it was a pretty bad time for her husband. I mean, he was not being very helpful, I have to say, but, you know, spending all his time working. But nevertheless, it must have been a difficult time because their social life, you know, really shriveled.
Were they becoming estranged from each other, she and Carl, at that time?
Gradually, yes, gradually.
Explain to me how JT's behaviour changed, began to change after a while.
Yes, what had happened is really she had become, she had hormonal changes, and she was now ready, had she been in the wild, to have a child and to be, you know, compete with other women for the possibility of having that child. And she has what Delia calls a brain snap. She starts to see Delia as a fellow woman rival, and she bites her on one occasion. I mean, it was, I mean, most of the time they were fine, but they had a kind of contretemps, and she bites her, and of course the very, very sharp teeth, she severs a whole series of nerves in her leg, and she is really seriously hurt. She is 3 months bedridden. The leg swelled up terribly, and she refused to leave the monkey. I mean, by this stage, she was kind of half mad herself. So the doctor had to come in and do the work on her, you know, in the apartment. And he said she just narrowly escaped having to have her leg amputated.
So there were several more nasty bites after that.
Yes.
And Carl, at that point, her husband, had had enough of living with a bitey monkey and ordered Delia to send JT to a zoo in Washington. So she was sent away. How did the loss of JT affect Delia?
She was so devastated, and of course there was a dual devastation. By this time, she and her husband were at utter odds, and she felt she had lost her child. You know, she dashed off as soon as possible, spent as much time as possible at the zoo communicating with the monkey. Meantime, they were arguing so fiercely at home, she eventually, in early 1918, she leaves and goes to a hotel. She decides, in fact, that she must get away, and so she wants to go to France to help in the war effort. She wants to get away from looking after herself and to look after other people. And she'd been looking after monkeys, you know, for a long time, and she now wants to go and look after people. So she gets permission from her husband, which you needed, to get a passport, and she goes over to France just in the last year of the war to help the American troops in Paris and in Nancy nearby.
So that meant she was out of the United States and couldn't visit JT in the zoo. When she got back, what state was JT in at the zoo?
Well, when she got back, JT was in a terrible mess, really. She had been put into a cage with a young male vervet who had completely and utterly bullied her, taken her food, you know, constantly pulled out her hair and so on. So she comes back, you know, fighting her own husband. They were now absolutely at loggerheads, and finding JT is being abused by her husband, if you like. Oh,
she must have been shattered by that. That must have been an awful thing to see.
She was shattered by it. And the JT was really had lost a lot of weight, was thin and scared, and she felt, you know, this tremendous guilt.
Had JT forgotten her?
Not in the least, no. You know, JT completely knew her. They had, you know, she always used to bring particular treats when she came to the zoo. They had particular ways of communicating. She used to communicate in kind of monkey noise. She developed ways of speaking that she sort of imitated the monkey world. And so JT was completely elated when she came to see her, but then devastated by the ferocity of this young male.
JT died in 1924. How did Delia hear of JT's death?
Delia had been fighting a kind of divorce, a terribly savage divorce with her husband. And, you know, when she finds out about JT's death, while in the midst of all this, she gets a message sent from the zoo that JT has died. And she's completely and utterly devastated. At the same time, she's in this awful battle with her husband. She hated the fact that she was in a cage. She hated the fact that the monkey was being bullied by this male. And she thought, well, the poor little animal is free at last. And she felt tremendously guilty I mean, I don't think she ever really got over the guilt at having, in effect, you know, made a child out of her monkey and then ended up with the monkey being in captivity.
This was all happening at the same time she'd announced that she was going back to East Africa and into the Belgian Congo without, obviously, her husband, whom she was in the middle of that acrimonious divorce, as you said. What was she planning to do while she was in Africa?
Well, she had to make a living and, you know, she had to survive. And so the only thing she knew was going on safari in Africa. So she persuaded the Brooklyn Museum to let her lead an expedition on her own, scarcely any money because Brooklyn Museum was not wealthy. She was going to go to Africa and she agreed to get some specimens, mainly of antelopes, for the museum. Secondly, she wanted to study the animals, especially baboons and monkeys and so on, that she had become so much part of her life. I mean, I think in one way she sort of half thought she was an animal. And then she was wanting to go to the Congolese jungle to explore and find out about the life of pygmies in the jungle. Especially she was interested in the life of the women. She was now becoming more and more of a feminist, I think, having had such a terrible time. I mean, I need to tell you that her husband, during the time of their battles, actually tried to get her sectioned and taken and put into a lunatic asylum. They had actual fights and physical fights. So, you know, she was more and more, I suppose, feeling I'm on my own. The only thing I know what to do is to go to Africa and to find out about the things that she was fascinated by and come back and tell people about them.
So back in Africa and on the Tana River where she'd met JT all those years ago, she began to observe the behaviour of baboons. Why was she particularly fascinated by baboon behaviour that she saw at the time?
She discovered that baboons had a very complex social regime, I suppose, and it was an extension of her interest in the vervets and others. But she watched baboons at night and she communicated with the baboons. Have always an old watchman at the bottom of the tree. You know, they go to sleep up the tree and it's all hierarchical with the babies at the top.
You mean a baboon watchman?
A baboon watchman,
right.
Yeah. So an old baboon watchman is there looking after things all through the night. And so she would stay there and communicate with him.
Tell me what happened when she saw a leopard stalking this troop of baboons.
Yeah, one day this group of baboons that she's watching, the mothers are there with the babies playing, and she was, you know, as you could imagine, she was absolutely ecstatic watching this happen. And then she sees out of the corner of her eye a leopard creeping up. And one female gives her baby to the others and the rest of them scarper, and she waits there to fight the leopard.
On her own?
On her own. As she sort of sacrifices it, really. She's killed instantly. She's ripped from the top right to the bottom of herself. But at this time, out come a couple of old males to fight the leopard. And this fight goes on and they end up tearing the leopard to pieces. They kill the leopard with their bare hands.
She found a guide to take her deep into the jungle in the Belgian Congo, as it was then, to visit a village of pygmy people. Tell me about what that was like and what she did and saw during those weeks she spent with the pygmy people.
Yes, so very few people had ever actually got to see these pygmy people. They live in very, very deep in the Congolese jungles. They're called Batwa and Bambuti people. She'd heard about them, and she's eventually taken to a small Bambuti village of about 30 people in the middle of the jungle. And she then spends time with these people, studying their life, talking to them, living as they lived, and finding out about the complexity of their lives, and especially interested, of course, in the women and their relationship to children. She becomes one of the pioneers, I suppose, of our understanding of pygmy life. But as far as that was concerned, when she first saw the Batwa, she thought that they were pretty uncivilized. They lived a very mobile kind of life. They just make a little shelter with plants for the night. She gradually discovers that they in fact have a very complex life, and she even gets to know their medical skills, and she sees somebody actually do a medical kind of removal of the top of the skull when there was pressure on, and
like trepanning, the old-fashioned trepanning. Wow.
Yeah, absolutely amazingly, with a spear, you know, and the person survives completely. She really, really does get a great deal of knowledge about them and brings it back to America.
So on her return to the United States, to New York, she was hailed as a heroic explorer of her time. But by then, her ex-husband Carl had died in the jungle of a fever, and she entered into this very unedifying duel with Carl's next wife that he'd married, Mary. How ugly did it get between the duel between these women?
Things don't get much uglier. So the thing is, Carl had remarried a very, very influential socialite woman with a lot of knowledge who was linked to the museum. She was somebody who had a great deal of social power.
And she saw herself as the keeper of the flame of her dead husband, too.
Absolutely.
By the sound of things.
She actually felt she was in communication with her husband, and she wrote an enormous book called Carl Akeley's Africa, which was a bestseller, all about her relationship with Carl, which incidentally, she'd only been with him for 2 years, and she completely expunged Delia from the history.
Delia, on the other hand, wrote two wonderful books, and both of them sank pretty much without a trace, sadly. And by the late 30s, you write, she'd been pretty much totally eclipsed by Mary in many ways. Was she shunned? Was Delia shunned by the natural history world in the United States at that point?
She certainly was shunned by the museum. She was arguing she wanted to, in effect, her survival depended on telling the story of what she'd done and learnt in Africa. And her place had been completely taken by the very, very jealous second wife. And this very powerful and jealous second wife, I mean, she manages to extinguish one of Delia's most important contributions, which is the first biography of a monkey ever written.
This was the biography of JT that she'd written?
Yes, it was a biography of JT, and the wife, the second wife, Mary Job, gets a big parcel of tough lawyers to go in and intimidate the publisher so that the publisher turns it into a children's book, just publishes it a children's book. And of course it's not. It's an extremely sophisticated adult analysis of monkey's life.
So this is a proper bit of primatology, in other words, that's being put on the kids' shelves in the bookshop.
And once it's on the kids' bookshelf, no kids can read it, and it just sinks without a, you know, like a stone.
So she was unable to make a living on her own then. What did she do about that? How did she turn that around for herself?
Well, she has basically for you know, nearly 10 years, she's battling the museum and battling Mary Job, trying to reestablish a career that is being completely extinguished. And finally, in 1939, she gives up. She thinks she's lost this battle. And she marries in 1939 a businessman who had actually been a friend of her husband. And in doing that, she, in effect, recovers her life for the first time. She has had no money up to that point. She has been desperately trying to find a living. And now she's married to a wealthy man. And for the first time in her life, she's able to really relax and live an ordinary, quiet life.
She outlived her rival, Mary, and was thought to have been 100 years old when she died in 1970. Good God. Having read this story, I see her, Ian, as a brave, brilliant but a completely infuriating human being. Did her contemporaries see her that way, or did they see her differently?
I think it depended on which contemporaries you meant. She was very warm, and so, she, you know, the friends that she makes loved her all her life. She was also fiery and passionate, and you're right, you know. So this is a woman with a very extreme personality in a way.
Who keeps a monkey in an apartment for all those years? That's just...
It's extraordinary.
Extraordinary, really. Yeah. It's not, I don't know, it's not cruel, but it's fascinating nonetheless. How do you see her now, Ian?
I see her as a tragic figure in a way. You know, she came from a very poor background. She had very little education. She was extremely bright and became a beautiful writer, but had a very, very tough life. She becomes involved with the alternative world of monkeys, and I think, you know, never really breaks free from it, but is never at the same time completely normal. You know, she's become monkeyized in a way.
Now, you're an historian, Ian, and so, of course, the great sin in history is to be guilty of the sin of what's called presentism, which is to look back on the values of the past and go, oh, we're so much smarter now because we think this, whereas they thought that. And this is only 100 years ago, where it's perfectly all right to go out with a gun and shoot these beautiful animals for sport. Do you have a view on all of that, Ian?
I do feel the same way. I do feel the same way. It's really why I was initially intending to write a book about my great uncle, but I found myself so disgusted by the killing and the slaughter of animals, albeit supposedly, you know, well, partly for pleasure and partly for science. It is impossible to deal with, and I think these are things that are not permissible. There's a point at which we can't say, oh, well, you know,
that was then and this is now. Yeah.
That was then and this is now. I think this is a point where we do require to make moral judgment. And in the time of slaughtering animals, there were people who opposed it. And, you know, in the end, Delia Akeley was one of those.
Well, it was a hell of a thing to find a kind of a lantern in the darkness of all of that in the life of Delia Akeley. And it's been great to speak with you about her, Ian. And thank you so much.
Thank you. It's just lovely speaking to you.
Ian McCalman is an historian and he's the author of a new book called Delia Akeley and the Monkey. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.